Even though I had nothing, in the traditional sense, to qualify me as a chef or a business owner, I had something convincing and compelling from my early 20s. From that era with the chicken, and my dad shouting at me from the back steps, and me wanting to sleep the long, permanent sleep. I had something from that time. From all that sitting on the woodpile that aimless fall, imagining the death of everything from garden tomatoes to small animals to the mailman. That time when I loathed and despaired of the self I had become, whatever self that was, so hastily cobbled together in an emergency. I had something persuasive. Those gloomy thoughts at dusk with the cigarettes turned from thoughts of my own death, which I, an otherwise healthy and robust and well-mannered 19-year-old, couldn't in good conscience accomplish, to significantly politer thoughts of disappearing, which I could. And soon, out of pragmatic consideration for others and a deeply ingrained adherence to good manners, I had planned my own clever death without actual death. I would leave, disappear, send an occasional postcard, and be done with the whole dilemma. Goodbye, world. Goodbye, New Jersey. Goodbye, family, God, and country. Hello, Ural Pass. My mother, still protractedly adjusting in Vermont, now dabbling in women's groups and long herbal tea-soaked conversations of spirituality, kindly sent a list of friends and family in France and their phone numbers, which I planned to tuck away and forget about. My father, now dating all sorts of ill-fitting but dazzling younger women, not only opened up his house for a farewell party to which I invited the whole crew from Mother's, but he also offered to take on my student loan payments for as long as I was gone. Todd offered a Bon Voyage professional model Nikon camera with a powerful lens that must have cost $1,000. And so equipped, I arrived at a youth hostel in Bruges from New Jersey on a one-way, $99 People Express ticket. It was January 1986. I had a heavy backpack, a heavy sleeping bag, empty notebooks, and $1,200 in American Express traveler's checks. When my idea was formed on the woodpile that fall, a slow and meandering two-year trip around the world where I might be swallowed and digested and composted by the earth itself, with the sum of my existence rolled up into a backpack, I failed to account for the weather. It was the coldest winter Europe had seen in 50 years. Each day in January in 1986 was, I recall, below zero. My feet were frozen. My hands were frozen. I just wanted to stay inside the youth hostel and write down my dark thoughts. This youth hostel, the Bauhaus, was owned by two brothers who came in and out with cases of UHD milk and laundered fitted sheets, both of them tall, with strong features and unruly hair, and between them a cassette collection that included Père Ubu, Brian Eno, Talking Heads, and Joy Division. The cozy little bar downstairs was pleasantly populated with a few travelers, mostly guys, mostly German and Australian. The girl behind the bar, Aimé, spoke a peculiar accented English that made it impossible to guess her origin, which I admired, and I immediately set about cultivating such an accent of my own. She was there each day and seemed helpful to the brothers in enforcing the rules that govern all accredited and certified youth hostels. Hostelers out by 10 a.m. each day. Hostelers may not re-enter the hostel until after 4 p.m. Hostelers must be 18 or older. In the morning, there was an included breakfast of watery coffee, overly sweet cheese wrapped in tinfoil packets, bread, and a few olives, over which you could not linger. Anxious about money, I ate the whole thing hungrily, unsure what else I would eat that day. Precisely at 10 a.m., we were pushed out. I began to call it the youth hostile. After a couple of brutally long and frigid days wandering around the deserted city, early and easily reaching my fill of the famous but only decent French fries, I circled back in the afternoons, sheepishly noting that it was barely 3 minutes past 4 o'clock. In the almost empty youth hostel, for the rest of the evening, I sat alone in the little bar downstairs at the reception area and wrote in my notebooks as a few fellow winter travelers trickled in and sat, intensely discussing a certain guest house in Rangoon, while the exquisitely detached girl still behind the bar poured their drinks and braided colored thread into bracelets. Every evening, I ordered glasses of red wine from Aimé and sunk into the comfort of every cassette she played, from Suzanne Vega to U2 as if something familiar, something from your own life, even if it was just the soundtrack of it, could warm all of your frozen bones. Amsterdam was what I had mapped out next that frigid winter, and I questioned whether it might be warmer or colder there, and if, taking into account the conversation that travelers around me were now having about Bang Lassies in Trivandrum and blotter acid in Goa on New Year's Eve, if I even cared. Within 5 evenings, I had already filled one of my notebooks with questions of my purpose as well as my stamina. Dead of winter is not the most wholesome time to backpack in Europe, and January in Amsterdam found me in a huge open dormitory room with only 3 other occupants, the other 40 or so beds between theirs and mine, empty. They'd been squirreled in there since October. The drugged-out girl and the 2 drugged-out boys, none of them native English speakers but all of them speaking to each other in English, were huddled together under 1 blanket on 1 bed at the alcove end of the room, near a trickle of brown water that was leaking from one of the 2 steam pipes that were intended to heat the room. The dormitory was as cold as outside, but without the wind. The threesome were slowly, very slowly, talking to each other. They were blotto. The girl, Israeli, was trying to get some drugs from the guy, Swiss, but it wasn't working out for her. She was too stoned to make a serious case, and he was too mean to not enjoy his small, fleeting power. He had the dope. She wanted the dope. This wasn't the harshest, he has the drug, she wants the drug scene I had ever witnessed, but neither was it the most benign, and it was the first in which I would have to spend the night trying to sleep in the same room with the transaction unfurling a few beds away. The third guy, possibly a local, wanted what there was of the Israeli girl and wasn't deterred, it seemed, by either her disinterest or the lack of privacy. Even though this was the one single city in the world where the guest houses, it seemed, allowed you to stay indoors the day long through if you wished, pouring it all out into your journal, I had to get out. That little gruesome threesome in the one cot with their blunted senses was enough to drive me to wander the empty city of Amsterdam, even in sub-zero temperatures. Like everybody, I was curious about the legal hash and the legal prostitution, of course. But back in New Jersey, when I had been thinking of including Amsterdam in my route, I also had thought I might wander the canals and see houseboats and Anne Frank's house and tulip farms and spend a couple of days cycling around the city. I wanted to see if anybody wore the clogs and if I could make it to the city of Gouda in a day trip to try the famous cheese where huge round yellow wheels of the stuff are traded at the market like a commodity. I wanted to tip my head back and drop the new fatty herring down the hatch and drink beer from a tap. But it was just the wrong season for this kind of travel. In all my months of studying the Atlas, and in my great victory in flying all the way to Europe for only $99, I totally had fucked up and arrived in the heart of the wrongest season. No bicycles, no clogs, and no herring. After trudging around for hours, while the tall, good-looking, and sensually emancipated Dutch retreated inside their homes and kept warm, I wandered into a coffee shop, the Dutch kind with legal drugs for sale, anxiously calculating my money, already down to $1,000 from the $1,200 I'd started out with only a week before, and regretting the wastefulness of now having a few useless Belgian francs in my pouch, but determined to have a Dutch experience. I felt jittery from caffeine, from hardly letting myself descend into full, unguarded sleep all the nights before, and from a chill so permeating, now made more deep by the dampness of canals and seawater. I stood for a long time staring up at the blackboard menu of drugs available and finally decided to try the space cake. But the blonde girl at the dealer's counter and the fact of her heavily applied silver eyeliner somehow suddenly made me feel unsafe. Someone at a little table had passed out from the force of whatever she'd sold him. He was slumped over and fully blacked out, and I found myself unable to go through with it. Of all the times I've needed to be fully in possession of my wits, here and now, totally alone in the world with my whole existence crammed into my pockets, was the most urgent of all. I backed out into the cold street, starting to really unravel and nearly defeated. Several blocks later, I found a cafe, the European kind with coffee and snacks, and went in it to warm up and to sort out some of my anxieties. I ordered a sandwich and sat in the grip of my own fuck-up. Impossible to go back home, impossible to wander another frozen minute in another impenetrable city, impossible to last much longer on my dwindling traveler's checks, and impossible to go straight to balmy, exotic, and indecipherable Indonesia until I'd gotten some more experience as a lone female traveler in friendly, Western, recognizable Europe, until the waitress put the plate in front of me. There was, as I'd ordered, a cold ham sandwich on good buttered grainy bread, but it came with a warm salted potato and a wedge of gouda that had aged so much that it had gritty, very pleasant granules in it, which at first I thought were salt grains, but then realized were crystallized calcium deposits from the milk of the cheese. I ate the little potato right away. Its pale yellow flesh was perfectly waxy, and its skin snapped when I bit into it. I don't know under what other conditions a simple, salted, warm-boiled potato could ever taste as good as this tasted. Probably none. Usually the food that meets your hunger sends you into a calmed and expansive state of deep satisfaction, but I, instead, sat in that cafe and became quite heavy and defeated. Yes, I had wanted to leave everything behind. I had grown to hate my country, my culture, my own first and last name. But the sharp and creamy cheese, the starchy, warm, small potato, somehow made it starkly apparent how weary and lonely and physically uncomfortable one could become in exile. I had fantasized I would be gazing at the Van Goghs while my bicycle with the basket rested outside against a lamppost, unlocked. But instead, I had just seen some guy in a coffee house fully blacked out at the table. I was about to return to three drugged out and frightfully skinny roommates. I needed a better plan. Slowly savoring the last bites of my ham sandwich on that corky pumpernickel bread, I pored over my travel notes and found the letter from my mom with the list of her relatives and friends in France. There was also a contact in Algeria, the family of one of the dishwashers from Mother's, but when I imagined trying to manage that phone call, shouting over the static from an international booth at the post office, our words overlapping in the delay, and trying to cheerfully introduce myself while asking if I could be their guest for, well, several weeks, I immediately opted for France. I would be welcome there. Marie-Noël had a crêperie, tabac, and bar de sport in the tiny town of Montauban de Bretagne. I was silently thrilled to get off the train and, not one other backpacker or drug addict in sight, be met by this luminously blue-eyed old friend of my mother's. "Gabrielle," she waved. "Marino, salut!" And we were off, my heavy pack in the back of the Volkswagen Rabbit, and she, as if I were her peer, began to speak of everything, complex and troubling, simple and pleasing, that had arrived in her life these past many years since we had seen each other. We drove through small villages on our way from Rennes to Montauban and pulled up finally to her little spot in the center of town. The bar was closed on a Sunday evening, and so we went without interruption upstairs to her apartment and settled me into the attic room. While I unpacked a little and arranged my things, Marie-Noël put together a simple dinner of soup and cheese and brought it up to her room on the second floor, where she said she preferred to eat in the winter when it got dark so early and the nights were so very long. Her husband, of a few years, had just months before killed himself by mouthing a hunting gun and pulling the trigger right in front of her. I slept more that night than I had in 30 days combined, it seemed, relieved beyond description to not have to keep nocturnal watch over my traveler's checks and my passport and my expensive camera, which all of the winter drug addicts in every youth hostel I slept in would have razored out of the bottom of my sleeping bag while I slept, had I not remained, even in sleep, alert. When I came down to the bar to find Marie-Noël, the place was open and busy, and there was the smell of coffee being ground each time an Olay was ordered. The room was warm and simple, with a stand-up bar, a small area at the cash register for lottery tickets and cigarettes, and a separate area with a pool table and a table soccer game up a few steps in the back. The crêperie, with its heavy black cast-iron griddles and just a few tables, was in another room open and adjacent to the bar. She put me to work at the bar at first, pulling espresso and steaming milk. She introduced me to one of the stout and ruddy-complexioned farmers, and as we shook hands, his rough and calloused, clasping mine, I said, "Bonjour, Roger." And Roger bowed slightly and said, "Enchanté, mademoiselle," revealing his brown teeth. Marie-Noël taught me how to pour his little ballon of vin rouge ordinaire with a good splash of water in it, because at 8:30 in the morning, he and all of the other blue-clad men with terrible teeth who now stood against the bar, with manure and red dirt stuck to their black rubber boots, were on their first of many to follow. Throughout the day, they would stop back in for un coup while their tractors sat haphazardly parked on the side of the road just outside. Bottles of Pernod, Ricard, and my favorite, the bitter orange-flavored Suze, hung upside down from a clever rack, and I learned to push the glass up against the spring-fitted nozzle to drain out a perfect one-ounce pour. The eggs sat out at room temperature in the kitchen, and Michel, the crêperie cook who wore big, thick-lensed glasses that made his eyes huge above his mustache, let the cigarette dangle from his lips as he cracked them into the crepe batter, made of buckwheat flour, each day. The salad dressing was made in the bottom of the bowl with garlic, mustard, vinegar, and oil, and tossed in with the bib lettuce that we bought at the little open-air market that set up every morning across the street. I stood often with Marinot at her post at the cash register and sold lottery tickets, Gitane, Galloise, and Rothman Rouge by the carton, and from the register I could look straight into the crêperie where Michel spooned out the batter onto the oversized black turntable griddle and then swirled his little dowel of a baton around like a DJ scratching the beat. He was decisive and swift, and he cracked the egg right onto the galette and sprinkled the grated gruyere and laid out a slice of that jambon with a white fat cap over and over again, working the two griddles effortlessly. To finish and plate each galette, he used his metal spatula to fold in the four sides, forming a square from a circle with the contents exposed still at the center, and deftly ran the spatula under the savory crepe, delivering it to the plate. "Et voilà," he said each time, and then turned to the next. That meal, with the salad right on top of the complet, and a bottle of the hard cider kept at truly cellar temperature in an actual cellar, was one I ate every day without ever getting bored of it. I had never before given a single thought to how different the lettuces and the cider and even the butter, bread, and eggs tasted when left at room temperature and never refrigerated, but now I was keenly aware of it. For the duration of the winter, I hibernated inside her warm little hub of life in that tiny village, and earned a few francs by working every day in the bar or the crêperie or at the cash register selling cigarettes and lottery tickets. I fixated on the local shops, the boulangerie, poissonnerie, boucherie, fromagerie, and pâtisserie, and how they displayed their foods in that careful, precise, and focused way that never, in spite of all that precision and care, looked rigid or antiseptic or strained. Every piece of food in every store, no matter how artful, precise, and often jewel-like, begged to be touched, smelled, and heartily eaten. We bought bread at the bread store, meat at the meat store, dry goods at the dry goods store. There was a huge supermarket that had just been built at the edges of the town, but when we went there, to get something in bulk supply for the bar or crêperie, Marie-Noël kind of smiled sheepishly and moved quickly across the parking lot to the car. In town at the local boucherie, though, the rabbits and pheasants and geese were displayed in the cases with some remnant of their living life still with them. The geese were laid out with their long necks arranged in great question mark arcs around their totally plucked bodies, as if they were not dead but simply deep in sleep, their black beaks and faces nestled in striking contrast to their bare, creamy bodies. The rabbits looked like clipped show poodles, wearing fuzzy slippers, otherwise skinned, but their furry feet left intact while their little bloody faces revealed their tiny, bloody teeth. Pheasants in full, stunning plumage hung for a few days until their necks finally gave out, and you could see, physically, a kind of perfect ripeness to the meat when it became tender enough to pleasurably chew, as if the earliest stage of rot itself was a cooking technique. Boudin blanc and boudin noir overran the charcuterie and traiteur cases as Christmas and New Year and Saints' Days in the deep of winter demanded these traditional foods, made only at this time of year when animals are slaughtered, not bred. Young cooks who desired to be chefs went to auberges in the countryside of France and slept on cots and worked without pay for 16 hours a day, 6 days a week. They did these apprenticeships called stages, which I never heard of until well after I'd opened my own restaurant. Of course, I had never worked anywhere in my life where young people apprenticed for free in hopes of learning something valuable. The Canal House and the Picnic Basket and Mother's were the kinds of restaurants where the only thing that mattered to anyone was their paycheck their tips, and their free shift drink. People who knew about staging were French boys on the cusp of manhood who lived in France and spoke French, and when they were 14 and clearly not cut out for the books at their lycée, would wander down the road to their local two-star inn and tap on the screen door of the kitchen there. They joined, at the bottom, the ranks of a brigade kitchen and did their little part learning how to be clean, fast, efficient, and perfectly repetitive. They plucked the feathers from partridges that arrived through the back doors of the kitchens. They quickly washed berries picked by local men and women from their own bushes. They scrubbed copper as punishments. I knew nothing of it, not one detail. I didn't even know such an apprenticeship existed or that anyone would aspire to such a thing. I was clearly in no two-star country auberge. The locals, Riton and André and Yannick, all of them strangely cross-eyed, chain-smoking, semi-literate drunks, leaned too many days a week and too many hours a day against that bar where I was understanding for the first time the chasm between coffee ground to order per cupful and what I'd slurped every morning from Dimitri with my egg on a roll, which came out of a stainless steel tank. The patrons and crew of our little sports bar cum creperie on that gray corner in that drab small town resembled nothing of the fine dining clientele of a two-star Relais and Chateau Inn, nor its brigade. Michel, always in street clothes with the same apron used for the whole work week unwashed, smoking while mixing crepe batter, and Marie-Noël, nervously sipping her tisanes to calm her ever since Eve had offed himself, and the barmaid Sylvie, with her long black hair rarely washed and never pulled back, who seemed to know just the right time to pour a free round, and who very warmly received the flirtations of the cross-eyed, toothless, shit-stinking admirers, resembled not one aspect of a toqued brigade meticulously fluting mushroom caps. Nonetheless, everyone had an opinion about the baguette at breakfast, and everyone knew how to prepare a simple roast chicken and a few potatoes cooked in the local, heavily salted butter. Everyone casually tipped the last sip of the red wine from their glass into their dish of soup and mopped it all up with the crusty heel left in the bread basket. I was sucking something in, something unmitigated. This is the crepe. This is the cider. This is how we live and eat. This man with bits of straw stuck to his thick blue Breton sweater, leaning up against the bar for a ballon of vin rouge ordinaire with a splash of water in it at 8:30 in the morning, is the farmer whose milk we have been drinking, whose leeks we have been braising. These are the knotty, wormy, quite small apples from which the cider is made. And here, as a treat to celebrate my last day before continuing on my journey, when we drove to the coast, past fields of shooting asparagus and trees about to burst forth, and we stopped finally at the water's edge in Saint-Malo, here are the platters of shellfish pulled that very morning from the sea, langouste, langoustine, moule, crevette, huître, bouleau, bigorneau, coque. These are the pearl-tipped hatpins stuck into a wine bottle cork for pulling out the meats of the sea snails. The tide ran out, and the fishing boat slumped in the mud attached to their slack anchors like leashed dogs sleeping in the yard. The particular smell of sea mud went up our nostrils as we slurped the brine from the shells in front of us, so expertly and neatly arranged on the tiers. Chin chin! Marino and I saluted each other, celebrating these past few months, and clinked together our glasses of Muscadet sur Lys. I am aware, in hindsight, that no real chef or restaurateur, when signing the 30-year lease on her first restaurant, thinks back suddenly to the miserable beginnings of her wintry backpacking trip and considers it as part of her business plan. I now fully understand that instead of conjuring peak food moments in my life and trying to analyze what had made them so important, as if that was some kind of legitimate preparation for tackling the famously difficult restaurant business, I really should have been crawling up into the pipework, noticing the water damage in the basement, and asking hard questions of Eric about the infrastructure of the 100-year-old tenement building. If I had even known what one was, I should have asked about the C of O. While I was dreaming of how I would someday get that gouda and that warm salted potato into the mouths of future guests, I should have been researching the restaurant's certificate of occupancy, arguably the most basic important document your restaurant will ever need. I'd never heard of due diligence, but there I was, pacing around my apartment, puzzling out how I could harness 100 pivotal experiences relating to food, including hunger and worry, and translate those experiences into actual plates of food, and wondering if $8 was too much to charge for a wedge of aged Gouda cheese and a couple of warm, salted, boiled potatoes. Of course, it wasn't a stage. It was not a real education in a real kitchen. It was just a few months of living at the source of something, rather than reading about it in a food magazine or learning about it from a chef instructor in a starched and monogrammed jacket at cooking school, in the lifeless context of stainless steel and Insta-read thermometers. I didn't consider it, at the time, anything pertinent to my future, but I was emboldened to sign that lease, in part because I had learned about buckwheat galette and white flour crepe and room-temperature lettuce and salted butter and cellared hard cider in a typical Breton crêperie. And it didn't end, this inadvertent and unconventional stage, with our kisses on both cheeks on the train platform in Rennes as I said goodbye to Marino and headed on to Paris, and then the rest of my life in petit exil, as I had initially planned. There was more than a full year ahead of me, 3 months in India, 7 months in Turkey, 1 month in Thailand, 6 months in Greece, during which I came to understand the differences and eventually to even have preferences between the milk from a certain wala in Delhi and one in Rajasthan, the cooking of eggplant in Turkey over the cooking of eggplant in Greece, the sugar derived from beets in Romania and from cane in Cuba, for example, that would become part of my education as a cook. There were uncomfortable bus and train rides that lasted for several days and nights, which I relied upon repeatedly, that 3-day ticket keeping me sheltered and moving because it killed two birds with one stone, the cost of travel and the cost of shelter. And so I would find my seat and remain in it, not even peeing or smoking or stepping out onto the platform for a leg stretch for the entire journey from Paris to Athens, from Mahabalipuram to Varanasi, from Bangkok to Chiang Mai, from Istanbul to Ankara. And on those journeys, those crossings, I came to know extraordinary and particular hunger. As my initial $1,200 in traveler's checks dwindled down uncomfortably, I stared out the window of that bus or train in 3-day increments, in a glassy, light-headed state, wondering about those women in the fields in the bright headscarves, the acres and acres of lopsided sunflowers all draping over in the same direction as the sun shines, the small stone huts out in the fields, the gray-green dry trees with silvery leaves, flattened out by the heavy fear of how I would make it with just a few hundred remaining dollars. I did what I always do when I am afraid, and went quite still, with a total slackening of will or need. And I thought all of my thoughts, sifted through all of my old nostalgias, while couples fell asleep on each other's shoulders, bus drivers honked friendly hellos at each other through those panoramic windshields of their buses, little brush fires burned at night on the sides of the road, and solitary figures rode bikes shakily on the shoulder of the highway. I starved. And I starved so many times on this repeated 3-day bus ride or train journey from somewhere to somewhere else that I came to know every contour of my hunger in precise detail. When I came to be actually holding the keys to my new restaurant, wondering what credentials I possibly possessed for owning and operating such a place, I counted knowing hunger and appetite as one of them. It became such a recurring experience during this period when I was 20. To be starving and afraid of running out of money, as I wandered from Brussels to Burma and everywhere in between for months on end, that I later came to see it as a part of my training as a cook. I came to see hunger as being as important a part of a stage as knife skills. Because so much starving on that trip led to such an enormous amount of time fantasizing about food, each craving became fanatically particular. Hunger was not general ever for just something, anything, to eat. My hunger grew so specific I could name every corner and fold of it. Salty, warm, brothy, starchy, fatty, sweet, clean and crunchy, crisp and watery, and so on. This kind of travel, so distinctly prior to ATMs, debit cards, cash advance credit cards, cell phones, Facebook, and international SIM cards, is probably not even possible now. And it isn't right to romanticize it, you with a feathery mind and a too light body, sitting on your heavy pack without a penny of local currency, down to your last $260 in traveler's checks, with not one person on Earth able to locate you on a map in any more than the most general terms, and the local American Express office closed until Tuesday because of some local holiday or labor strike. To be picked up and fed, often by strangers, when you are in that state of fear and hunger, became the single most important and convincing food experience I came back to over and over that sunny afternoon humming around my apartment, wondering how I might translate such an experience into the restaurant I was now sure I was about to open down the block. I so completely understood hospitality and care from a bedraggled recipient's point of view that even before I came to understand how garbage removal is billed on square yardage of waste and that a commercial storefront should have a separate water meter from the buildings, I knew I had to somehow get that kind of hospitality into this minor little 30-seater in the as-yet ungentrified and still heavily graffitied East Village. Melissa had given me the address and phone number of a man in Athens before I'd left home with my backpack. And at one of those unromantic points, alone in a new country, wasted on the youth hostel experience, down to my last dollars, my expensive camera long since ripped off, I dug up Yanis's number. These calls were always hard for me. I had developed such an intense deal about self-reliance, I bristled against having to need or want anything or anyone, ever. But here I was in Greece, and I couldn't even read the alphabet on the signs in this new country. I'd eaten nothing but a raw red onion, a sack of salted pumpkin seeds, and a glass of warm dry vermouth in the previous 5 days. And so I gulped down all my embarrassment about having to ask for help and called ahead to this stranger, Yanis. He couldn't have made it easier for me. "Yes, yes," he shouted into the phone, speaking excellent Oxford English. "You are most welcome here. I will be at my offices in the afternoon. Can you make your way into Athens from Piraeus, or shall I come and retrieve you?" he shouted. "No, no," I shouted back. "I can make my way. I will just make my way into the city and call you again, if that is okay with you." "Yes," he shouted back, his welcome palpable. "I will await your call. I will be waiting." Yanis, probably 20 years older than me, with a big mustache and laugh lines all around his green eyes, met me in Ammonia Square, brought me to his apartment, and without even inquiring, set to work frying in olive oil 2 eggs with the darkest orange yolks I had ever seen, then sprinkled them with a coarse sea salt and cut a slice from a thick, crusty loaf of bread. In a blender, he mixed apple, honey, and milk and set this incredible, refreshing meal in front of me, beaming his huge smile. I was craving salt and starch, eggs and bread. In the evening, we were joined by a friend of his, and we walked to a restaurant near to the Acropolis. They knew the waiter by name, and he didn't even bother keeping track of how many drinks we ordered. He just brought to our table the big bottle of ouzo, put a rubber band around the bottle to mark the level of the contents, and then let us self-serve as we wished. However much we depleted from the rubber band mark by the end is what we paid for. Yanis, without wasting a moment on that awkward and tedious conversation that will unhappily precede so many hundreds and hundreds of future restaurant meals in all of our lives, whether to share or not to share, and whether or not there are food phobias and dietary restrictions among us, simply ordered food for the table without even consulting a menu, and so set the standard for me for all time of excellent hospitality. Just take care of everything. Is it considered more hospitable to discover your guests' preferences, their likes and dislikes? Is it rude to deny your guests choice and control over their experience? I don't know, but I forever want to arrive somewhere, hungry and thirsty and tired, and be taken care of as Yanis took care of us. I want to be relieved of making possibly poor decisions, to be spared the embarrassing moment when I, the guest, am asked to state my preference for red or white wine, meat or fish, sparkling or still water, when I know that whatever I say will be a decision rendered for the whole table. Delicious food and drink arrived at our table, and it was immediately clear how Yanis hadn't needed a menu or a survey of our preferences to order, because he simply presented a classic, traditional Greek meal. There was saganaki and tarama salata and skourdalia to start, some grilled lamb and octopus to follow, a classic salad with feta cheese, And the best part? A couple of raw sardines on a stainless steel plate that we cooked ourselves in pure alcohol set alight. But not before Kostas, roaring with laughter, sent one of them back to be traded in for a female. I could not for my life at that time have discerned between a male and a female sardine, nor the gustatory difference, but I laughed too, and felt 100 months of worry and care lift from my head, up, up, up into the orange-scented Greek night. Yanis said, "Tomorrow we will go to my house on the island. It is small, but I hope you will like it." Kostas smiled his huge smile, the only blue-eyed blonde Greek I'd ever met, and said, assuredly, "You will love it." Even if you hadn't been strung out in youth hostels for months, keeping constant, paralyzing track of your dwindling dollars, repetitively checking the pouch around your neck that held your passport and your money with a kind of obsessive worry, you would drink up this warmth and this generosity like it was ice-cold beer. Yanis was thrilled to show me his city, the food of his country, his house on the island, to give me a frothy glass of apple milk and honey to drink in the cool salvation of his terrace, where a small orange tree grew, giving off its perfume. And Kostas was right. I did love the island. I loved it so much that I stayed for months and found a job in a well-lit touristy restaurant in the center of the port that paid 1,000 drachmas a day, where I washed dishes and pots and cleaned all the calamari and made hundreds of koriatiki, the Greek salad with tomatoes and feta. The waiters wore black pants and white polo shirts and smoked a pack of cigarettes in a single shift. I made my home in a little hut I had built on the beach. I showered in the ocean, shat behind the rocks, slept under the stars, and spent those early days in Seriphos wandering the mountainside. Chamomile, mint, capers, oregano, thyme, figs, lemons, oranges. These grew so rampantly that when you walked, the herbs crushed underfoot and released their scent into the air. I followed narrow goat paths, and the shiny black licorice jellybean goat poops guided me to hidden fresh water and mountainside gardens tended by their owners who came and went on donkeys. At the top of the world, high up in the mountain away from everything, I would sometimes encounter an old man, a goat herder with his tinkling goats, coming down the mountain riding his donkey in a wooden saddle as his dog followed. "Herete," I greeted him, and he said back, "Yachera." And every night when I finished work, I walked to the very end of the port, to the last light before the vast darkness beyond the mountain jutting up out of the sea. There was a restaurant there. A few tables scattered in the yard under the long-needled pine trees where the locals went. Tourists had been swarming the Greek islands for decades, of course, and everyone knew of the wild nightlife in Santorini and the party yachts in Mykonos. But Seriphos was a world away, a tiny island in the undiscovered Kyklades, where only Greeks went, where the oven at the bakery in Livadi was still used communally, and town women brought their casseroles to bake in the ashes after the day's bread had been baked. And Margarita's little place there at the end of the port will forever be my idea of a perfect restaurant. Her son went out in his boat and fished, and whatever he netted and however much of it he caught is what was for dinner. If it ran out at 8 p.m., it just ran out, and people ached to see some delicious thing on the next table that they couldn't also have because there just hadn't been enough. If you wanted the lamb, it came saucy and ungarnished, alone on a plate. If you also wanted broad beans or potatoes, you ordered them separately, and she served them also on separate plates. Margarita, maybe only 40 but looking 60, with sun-hardened skin and thick working hands, rode her donkey, side saddle, up into the hillside and got everything she cooked from her garden. I walked there many times in the early mornings, and when you pushed open the little gate fashioned out of branches and bed springs, there was a rough and casual Eden inside, with olive trees, grapes, fig trees, zucchini and eggplant and tomatoes, and the wild greens called horta that she boiled in salted water to tame drabness and then drowned, delicious death, in her own olive oil. Her freshwater spring was covered by a heavy wooden lid, and in her shed she stored a few tools, some bags, and large vats of homemade copper-colored wine. Margarita, like many on the island, made her own wine. There was no menu, no daily special, no appetizers, entrees, and no dessert, ever. You either went into the kitchen and lifted the lids to see what there was, or let her come to your little table out in the dry grass, and she told you the 5 or 6 things she had available. She set out copper cups if you asked for Retsina, and little glass tumblers if you asked for her own wine, which she brought in a little metal pitcher. At the height of the season, when it got very busy for that push at 9 o'clock, especially on Fridays when the ferry from Piraeus churned into port, spilling Albanian gypsies with mattresses piled on top of their trucks, and the weekly mail, and trucks carrying fuel and dry goods, and Athenian weekenders looking for a relaxing weekend on the silent Iron Island, away from the traffic and pollution of the city, a 5-hour ferry ride away. You could wait at your table, ignored, for an uncomfortably long time, as she hustled from the kitchen to the yard carrying plates to different tables, and the cicadas fell from the trees above onto your waiting plates and your hair. And at the end of your meal, she would come to the table with a short pencil and start to tally your bill by scribbling directly on the paper tablecloth. She would ask you what you ate and drank, and she added up the numbers, accepted your cash, and after you left, she would clear the table and crumple up the cloth and stuff it in the garbage. In my new kitchen, I couldn't discern between a Freon tube and a condensation line in a lowboy reach-in refrigerator to save my life, but I had crystal-clear understanding about bringing the experience of Margarita, in translation, into it. So Eric began to put together an LLC and an operating agreement and a small group of investors to buy the lease out of bankruptcy court. And I signed all the papers the same way I took off on that one-way People Express flight, knowing absolutely nothing about what I was doing, but understanding that I had committed to it. And in a very short time, I was power washing walls in a floor-length rubber apron, rain boots, and ventilated goggles. I killed roaches, poisoned their nests, trapped rats, stuffed their little holes with steel wool and glass shards, while my girlfriend, in her own way, walked through the place, purifying it with a burning sage smudge stick, and read me my daily Rob Brezhne horoscope in support. My best friends were stopping by after work, scraping the walls, scouring every surface, using skewers and razor blades to get into every crevice of every appliance. We papered up the windows and worked into the night at every opportunity. While I continued to chef for a paycheck at the catering company, I kept two clipboards going side by side throughout the day, one for the catering crap and one for my exciting double life lived after hours. And on that clipboard, the lists went on for 30 pages and constantly renewed themselves even after I had crossed off the first 1,000 tasks in black Sharpie. Items I had never encountered in my professional life, I now tackled bravely. Determine second means of egress. Establish payroll account. Attend LCB public hearing. Estimate breakage. Recharge Ansel system. In the evenings, people I didn't know at all passed by constantly, saw the cleanup, and popped their heads in to ask excitedly if the old beloved French bistro was finally coming back to life. And when I said, "No, I'm sorry, this will be a new place," their faces sank in sadness and disappointment, and I struggled to feel confident. No fewer than 100 passersby asked hopefully if this would be a vegetarian restaurant, and pointed out that the East Village really needed some good vegetarian places. One guy suggested, earnestly, that we run the same menu as a busy and popular neighboring spot and hope for their overflow. Finally, I locked the door from the inside. I didn't have an ounce of what typically matters, but I had all that. And I wanted to bring all of it, every last detail of it. The old goat herder smoking filterless cigarettes coming down the mountain, crushing oregano and wild mint underfoot. Yanis cooking me 2 fried eggs without even asking me if I cared for something to eat. That sweet, creamy milk that the milkwala in Delhi frothed by pouring in a long, sweeping arc between 2 pots held as far apart as the full span of his arms from his cart decorated with 1,000 fresh marigolds into this tiny 30-seat restaurant. I wanted a place with a Velvet Underground CD that made you nod your head and feel warm with recognition. I wanted the lettuce and the eggs at room temperature, the waiter to bring you something to eat or drink that you didn't even ask for when you arrived cold and early and undone by your day in the city. I wanted the toasted manti from a Turkish wedding I'd been part of in Gürme, Nevşehir, the butter and sugar sandwiches we ate as kids after school for a snack, the tarnished silverware and chipped wedding china from a paladar in Havana, and the canned sardines I ate in that little apartment on 29th Street. The veal marrow my mother made us eat as kids that I grew to crave as an adult. We would have brown butcher paper on the tables, not linen tablecloths, and when you finished your meal, The server would just pull the pen from behind her ear and scribble the bill directly on the paper, like Margarita had done. We would use jelly jars for wine glasses. We would put a rubber band around the middle of the wine bottle, like I had done with Kostas and Yanis in Athens. And if you wanted to drink only half, you could pay for just half. Like Margarita's place at that far dark end of the port in Seriphos, when we ran out of lamb for the night, we would just run out. There would be no foam and no conceptual or intellectual food. Just the salty, sweet, starchy, brothy, crispy things that one craves when one is actually hungry. There would be nothing tall on the plate. The portions would be generous. There would be no emulsions, no crab cocktail served in a martini glass with its claw hanging over the rim. In ecstatic farewell to my years of corporate catering, we would never serve anything but a martini in a martini glass, preferably gin. I wanted all of that crammed into this filthy little gem that Eric was asking to show me as I whizzed by to park my car. The rest I imagined I could figure out, the hot water booster and the right size grease trap and the payroll service and the proper way to process a credit card transaction. I had a master's degree. I had figured out more densely loaded text than a standard commercial lease. I called my sister to make my announcement. I'm opening a restaurant. She'd become the food editor at Savour Magazine, whose offices were then downtown, near Tribeca, and she was commuting into the city from New Jersey. More than once a week, she crashed on our couch. "Can you look at my opening menu and tell me what you think?" "What are you going to call it?" she asked. "Prune." Chapter 9. One day I unlocked the restaurant in the morning, rolled up the heavy gate, got the ovens going, and then went downstairs to the basement prep area and turned on all the lights. I unlocked the office door and smelled it immediately and unquestionably. Human shit. I looked around, checking and rechecking the soles of my shoes for dog crap. I saw nothing. I put on my whites and apron and changed into my clogs and smelled it again, a big whiff of human feces. I checked the bottom of my clogs. Nothing. I unbolted the back door of the office, which leads to nowhere, a small passageway between buildings with an ultra-narrow and steep stairway up to street level. This is protected by a rickety chunk of chain-link fence so that random derelicts can't wander down off the street and jump up on the fire escape and rob the apartments above the restaurant. As soon as I pushed open the rusty old back door of the office, I found what I was, reluctantly, looking for. Someone with very loose bowels had managed to crawl over the chain-link fence and squat in my office doorway, unloading his guts onto the stoop and the door itself. It was half a mountain of soft, crusted-over, dark brown crap on the outside, where it had been left to dry, and soft, mustardy brown inside, the way guacamole gets when exposed to air. I'm not, unfortunately, the kind of person who would ever ask someone else to do something that I myself am not willing to do. So rather than save the delight for the Mexican porter who would arrive in a few minutes, I went and got the gloves and the dustpan and the pine-scented industrial cleaner and began. Some of the shit had settled into a pool in the gravel and debris outside my door. This I could more readily scoop up with the dustpan and knock out into the waiting garbage bag. But the rest of it had to be dealt with in hand-to-hand combat. With a kitchen side towel wrapped around my nose and mouth like an old-time bandit, I scraped and scrubbed and shoveled and doused the whole contaminated area until the whole world, it seemed, smelled so much like pine cleaner that it was equally unbearable. For days, like some kind of olfactory chiaroscuro, we breathed pine cleaner, but then there, at the very bottom of the inhale, there would be a subtle note of human shit. As I was finishing and surveying my morning's work, I looked up the narrow staircase to street level and lurched a couple of steps backward. On the second step from the top was a rat, a dead rat. Actually, the more I looked at it, a nearly dead rat. I could see it breathing, its body vaguely rising and falling with its last weakened gasps, and occasionally I could make out the tiniest, subtlest movement in an arm or the neck. This challenge I just did not want to tackle, especially not from below, and risk having it tumble down onto my head, or come magically to life just when I approached at eye level and have it gnaw at my face. I wanted a superior vantage point, so I re-entered the office, bolted the back door, walked through the pine-scented gas chamber, up the stairs, through the dining room, and out onto the street. Coming around the side of the building, I reached the top of the staircase and got a better look at the rat. He was still breathing, and yet the rat looked, corporally, if you will, completely dead, as if it had died at least a full day before. It did not seem biologically possible that it was living, the way its eyes were long ago caved in and dried out, and its mouth was in full rigor. Yet, unmistakably, its long, plump body was swollen and vaguely undulating. Then, I had no doubt whatsoever, it started to move, ever so faintly. The rat started listing heavily to its side, and only at the last second, when it started to slip off the second step, did I realize what I was witnessing. The rat slowly, like a sock filled with coffee beans, slouched over and landed with a pillowy thud on the third step, and then exploded with thousands of maggots teeming inside. What had looked like shallow breathing was the undulance of maggots at a meal. Ephraim, the porter, had arrived and was inside sweeping, but I just couldn't foist that onto someone else. I went and got a gallon of bleach. Not even a week later, I was on the Martha Stewart show demonstrating how to prepare Italian wedding soup. It was a glamorous day. They sent a sleek black car to pick me up. Me, in the back seat of a black Lincoln Town Car all the way up the Taconic to her studios in Connecticut. In my sunglasses, on my cell phone, dialing every friend in my phone's address book to narrate to them where I was at that very moment. In a private town car sent expressly for me. And then the hair, and then the makeup, and then the schlepper who fetches you a bottle of water and a cappuccino and a small plate of fresh-cut fruit. When the adorable production assistant at the studio had offered me a cappuccino, I was totally thrown. After all, that's my job. I'm the schlepper. Oh, no, no, please, thank you. That's so nice of you, but really, I can do it myself. Just show me where and I can fix myself a coffee or something, and I'll do it myself. Really, thank you, that's so kind of you. He stared at me a long second and said, I'll just get it for you. How do you take it? Okay, light, no sugar. I thanked him profusely when he brought it, and he told me a kind of alarming story about a famous chef from Boston who'd been on the show who was, apparently, a great deal more comfortable than I with the whole being served by the schlepper routine. Oof, that sounds ridiculous, I said. Well, he said, clearing the empty fruit plate, I don't know how you stay so humble. And I nearly burst out laughing with images of maggoty rats and the stench of human shit so very fresh in my mind. Oh, that's not a problem with this line of work, I said. And then what? The car dumps you back at the restaurant just before service. You swan through the joint in front of all your employees in your heavy 4TV makeup. The waiters and dishwashers and line cooks ooh and ah appropriately at your general fabulousness and want to know everything about Martha. How was she? Was she a bitch? And on you go in minute detail until it's 3 minutes before six and dinner service must start so everyone scatters back to their positions. And you, fabulous celebrity chef you, downstairs you see that the prep sink drain hole is clogged with slimy caul fat trimming that no one has bothered to clean out, and you, automatically, like a reflex, thrust your hands into the drain and spend a few good humbling moments digging unknown slimy shit out of the prep sink. But there was a brief minute, in the beginning, when I got a little swelled. I got seduced by customers coming up to the pass leading to the open kitchen and heaping praise upon me. I was stunned, glowing, swollen with their attention, weepy, brimming, beside myself. This is the best meal I've had in New York City, they said. This is better than Gramercy, they claimed. You're a genius, they declared. And then, soon after the best meal comment, a woman came walking up to the pass, straight toward me. I was smiling my prepared smile, expecting the praise, thinking, the sweetbreads are amazing. The woman reached across the slate counter to, I thought for a second, warmly touch me, and then I saw it, her empty cocktail glass with her napkin crumpled up in it. Can you put this somewhere? She asked, and as I took the glass from her hand, she grabbed the cuff of my chef's jacket and wiped her shrimp toast fingers on it. It took me 10 full seconds to climb down from my perch, but when I did, I smiled at her, warmly, genuinely, and I said, my pleasure, and I meant it. Chapter 10. Arlindo is this guy who lives in the building that the restaurant is in. He's from Brazil, I think, about 6'2" and weighs a bit too much, so much that he has man titties. The reason I know this is because he likes to stand outside on the sidewalk in front of the wide open French doors of the restaurant with no shirt on in the summer, in rivulets of his own sweat. Arlindo came to me very solemnly when we first opened, introduced himself as some sort of officer of the co-op upstairs, and asked if he could speak with me for just a few minutes. Not knowing then, it was October, that he would turn out to be the kind of guy who stands outside on the sidewalk in front of the packed restaurant on a hot day with his naked gut and sagging man titties hanging out, I welcomed him and sat down for what I expected to be some kind of new neighbor chat. "What's up, Arlindo?" I asked in a friendly new neighbor tone. Arlindo leaned in very gravely, hesitated dramatically, broadcasting to me with the pain on his face that what he had to tell me was so very difficult for him, but persevere he must, for my benefit. "I am sorry to tell you, to have to be the one to tell you," he started, in his thick accent and deep, beautiful baritone voice, but then broke off at 240 pounds, no match for the gravity of the job he had to do. He resumed. "I am sorry to have to tell you this, but you need to know that your employees are stealing from you." This was very early on when Prune had just opened, and so far my employees were like my girlfriend of 4 years, my best friend from college whom I'd known about 10, and myself. I felt the need to sit back, just an inch or two in my chair, like when someone casually mentions that they failed to take their bipolar medication that day. "Really?" I asked quietly. He knitted his brow in such emphatic sympathy that 8 or 10 deep lines of woe sprang up and arched over his sad, sad eyes like seagull's wings. "Yes," he said, solemnly shaking his head. "Huh," was all I could manage. And then finally, "What are they stealing?" "Well, you should see it, behind the building. I am picking up bottles and bottles of Kahlua and so many empty Budweiser cans. They are stealing your liquor and drinking it out back." At this, I actually scraped my chair back several inches from the table, which maybe he perceived as my shock at the profoundly upsetting nature of the news he had dutifully disclosed to me. But Prune didn't yet have a liquor license, and wouldn't get one for 6 more months, and when we did get one finally, I wouldn't be stocking Budweiser in a can or Kahlua either. So the sudden backing up of the chair was more about concern for my own safety when I realized I was alone in my restaurant, sitting across the table from this man who had just introduced himself as one of my landlords for the next 20 years, or however long my lease was. The next time I saw Arlindo was on the sidewalk in front of the restaurant again, this time in a muscle tee and with his head wrapped in a big bandage, like when you dress up for Halloween as a hospital patient and wrap toilet paper around your head a few times. He had just returned from the emergency room to get some stitches because that day, while painting his apartment, he climbed up the ladder to paint the ceiling, but had misjudged how far he was from the ceiling fan and got brained by one of the blades, stopping it dead in its tracks with his own head. The co-op lets him plant flowers out front and out back of the building and pick out the color of paint for the door trim and other responsibilities, and they give him the title of something like Vice Maintenance Manager, which makes him, in fact, an officer of the building. The only weird thing about the title is that it is not, we've discovered, an act of charity on the part of the co-op. They are in earnest with this assistant to the vice maintenance manager office, which I guess says all it needs to about the business upstairs. We've been tenants in the building here longer than the past two co-op presidents. They've been very sincere, earnest people, but I don't think they've been particularly qualified for their endeavors. There was one president, a sort of self-styled ambassador, a guy who seemed to feel his diplomacy skills were such that he could broker peace between nations. He used to walk into Prune in the middle of the crush of Sunday brunch, somehow genuinely expecting to take care of a little co-op business, an electric bill, a conversation about the boiler, and stand there stupidly in the middle of the fray, expectantly. Sunday brunch is like the Indy 500 of services at Prune. There is a roaring, thunderous stampede every 40 minutes as hordes of hungry, angry, mag-wheeled, tricked-out customers line up at the door, scrape the chairs back, take their seats, blow through their steak and eggs. This line is 2 full seatings long at 9:30, even though we don't open the doors until 10. They are waiting for the go flag. Some have physically harmed the hostess as they sprint to get a table. I once worked the host shift on a Sunday brunch at 38 weeks pregnant, and even my huge belly, my chronic shortness of breath, and my clear proprietary aura, you can just tell when I am in the room that I am not an employee. I exude ownership. Even that did not stop the stampede that is Sunday brunch. We do a little over 200 covers on a Sunday in 5 hours with only 30 seats, if that tells you anything. We hardly have the space on the tiny dining room floor to accommodate the crush of bodies, the trays full of Bloody Marys and beer backs going to every table, the large plates of eggs, potatoes, toast, and bacon sailing through the room. Everything at brunch goes on a large and heavy plate to accommodate all the things a brunch special requires: fat, protein, starch, double starch. You can't fit Eggs Benedict with a potato roasty and a side of coiled lamb sausage on a small, delicate plate. The staff are like professional drivers, taking the turns on two wheels, screeching around the room, getting the tables turned, the bloodies shaken, the eggs delivered, and then the bus tubs hauled back to the kitchen. The hosts program loud, rocking music to keep the pace what it needs to be, music that is otherwise forbidden at dinner and lunch service when we are seeking a more mature, civilized experience. The kitchen, for its part, is hunkered down, the two full rails packed with tickets that all look exactly the same because it's all pancakes, eggs, and bacon with no coursing to be done. Sunday is an order fire day. Every ticket comes in and is shouted out and is picked up immediately. We do not wait patiently while the customer enjoys a section of the New York Times over a nice bowl of homemade granola before firing up his sour cream and caraway omelet. We do not. We are sometimes laying down omelet pans on the flames by the half dozen and delivering that many omelets in as many minutes. My station, if I am expediting and not working eggs, is at the front of the pass where I can look out over the dining room while simultaneously keeping my focus on frantically assembling fruit salads, smoked fish platters, youth hostel breakfast plates, and ricotta with pears and figs and pine nuts, and buttering every piece of toast or English muffin that leaves this kitchen, which on a weekend is about 192 Thomases and 1,440 eggs. This is nothing compared to a hotel or even a big restaurant. The only thing that makes it monstrous is that we are doing it in a kitchen the size of a Lincoln Continental. In the middle of this high-octane frenzy is when Mr. United Nations strolls in, wearing cut-off shorts and flip-flops, and stands in the middle of what there is to our dining room as bussers, waiters, and customers blow by him on their way to the pass, the bus tub, or the table, with a wrinkled envelope in his hand containing our water bill or some other rather important item. Only to him could this look like the right time to talk to me about co-op business. Invariably, he gets flustered and hands the envelope to the bartender or a waitress who is relentlessly trained to be helpful and friendly no matter what, who shoves the envelope into the cash drawer behind the bar or in their apron pocket along with the dirty napkins and pens they've got accumulating in there. Or he hands it to me, and I retrieve it with buttery fingers and shove it in the first aid kit for safekeeping, where I forget all about it. All I can think is that if he had been left in charge of brokering the peace in a 1,000-year-old tribal nation, the ethnic cleansing would have been complete as he stood there in flip-flops, totally flummoxed. The only person from the co-op who's been with us from the beginning and still with us today is a renter, an elderly woman who looks like she's been avoiding animal protein for so long that her skin is now tissue paper and her hair is as brittle as shredded wheat. Annie memorized our phone number the day it was published and calls us every day to tell us to turn down the music. And she's got us on redial. In the first few months, we were energetically neighborly and ultra-accommodating to all of the needs of all of the people in the building upstairs, and the building next door, and the building on the block behind us, and the building on the north side of us, and the west side, and so on, until we finally realized that when you open a restaurant, you are a magnet for every lonely, angry, unfulfilled New Yorker who can't afford a better apartment, a haircut, or a meal in a decent restaurant. It's like shaking a tree and outfall all the critics, the naysayers, the people with allergies to even the smell of anyone else's success, or with litigious impulses over the sound of silverware in a dish rack being hosed down, or who call the fire department at the suggestion of meat grill smoke. You get all the people who moved from elsewhere to New York in the first place to bask in its nearly assaulting vibrance, but who now write letters to councilmen and form committees to make it more like Main Street back home. Annie's thing was black music. We could be listening to Joni Mitchell, Cat Stevens, Johnny Cash, and the Talking Heads all night long at a healthy volume, and she wouldn't ever call. And as soon as Angie Stone, Stevie Wonder, or Finley Quaid tracks hit the rotation, we could set our watches by it. The phone would ring, and Ms. Vegetarian in a faded terry cloth robe would be shrieking at us to turn it down. She would come down in her robe and nightcap and complain about the bass with a restaurant full of customers. To spare us both, we got with her and arranged a volume level together, she in her apartment, us downstairs in front of the stereo, both of us on the phone. Can you hear it now? Okay. Can you hear it now? Okay. How's this? Can you hear this? Until mutually, we agreed on a volume, and we took white paint and black permanent marker and labeled the level on the volume knob Annie with 2 exclamation points so that any host of any shift would know what not to go above. But after a while, she would again start to call constantly, and when she complained that she was now sleeping in a hammock made of egg crates in her kitchen on a pulley system high above her dish cabinets so that the vibration from our sound system wouldn't keep her up at night, we kind of realized it wasn't us or our music. Our sound system is 2 shitty speakers from J&R Music World. We're a small bistro, not a rave club with bouncers on headsets. These people make entertaining characters in your journal or your published essay or your after work with beers bullshit session. But in the main, a 6'2", 240-pound guy with no shirt on, wandering around the building while I'm alone in it, can actually feel incredibly menacing. On an average day in my life, I could do without the added color they provide. This work is intensely stressful on its own. The hours are already long. The physical demands are significant. The egg shift at Sunday brunch alone could take down an average man. That heat in the egg station at brunch has a formidable physical presence. It moves about, undulating, coming at you in waves, some of them, like when you open the oven door, smacking you forcefully enough to tighten the skin on your face and make your eyes swell shut slightly. Much has been written about facing the shocking heat of a restaurant set of burners, and in spite of what it may reveal about me, I am the only one I know who likes it. I always feel like I am a contender in a nicely matched bout every time we meet, especially every Sunday, when I enter that station at 7:30 in the morning and begin my setup. Every time I step in front of those 10 burners, in that egregiously tight space, less than 12 inches between the wall I am backed up against and the burning stovetop in front of me, I feel like we are 2 small-time boxers, me and the heat, meeting in the center of the ring to tap gloves. The fight begins with a little slap, totally manageable, when I put that first large pot of water on to boil, and then increases in ferocity from there when the large cast-iron skillet starts to vaguely shimmer and smoke and sputter, magnifying the already immense power of my opponent, inching up the temperature as I start to render the pancetta for the carbonara. When the pig urine stench of that excellent pancetta hits me in the nose, I am red-eyed and snotty. Your nose runs in the heat and in the cold equally as it attempts to regulate your body temperature, and it's only 8 o'clock in the morning. That your eyes are already a little swollen and your nose is running and your skin is tight on your face gives you a raging bull kind of feeling, which gets me immediately in the right mindset. The whole crew feels it, that tension before a fight. The customers lined up outside before we have even turned on the lights and had our family meal. The total knowledge of what we know is coming, the relentless, nonstop 5-hour beating. And we practically huddle up, poised for the bell. We are scared even, saying in psyched but tense tones, "Here we go," as Julie unlocks the door and they flood in, scraping the chairs, and that milk foamer on the espresso machine rages its monster roar, and we stand motionless in the kitchen, looking out onto the floor, waiting for the panic of tickets, tickets, tickets. It's important not to go down early in your shift, and there are things that will bring you down. You start your first ticket of the day, and by accident, you tip a full gallon of pancake batter over in your reach-in, both wasting a product you desperately need and now creating a jam in your reach-in because you can't work with pancake batter all over everything. The expediter does not stop calling out tickets just because you have a mess in your station. The orders, all of them at least in part your responsibility because every dish at brunch comes with eggs, keep pouring in while you hustle to get that glop cleaned up and your station back on track. The circumstances won't change. You are always, always going to face forces that can bring you to your knees. No matter how well set up you are, how early you came in, how tight and awesome your mise en place is, there will be days, forces, events that just conspire to fuck you, and the struggle to stay up, to not sink down into the blackest, meanest hole, to stay psychologically up and committed to the fight is the hardest, by far, part of the day. The heat, the crush of customers, the special orders and sauces on sides, the blood sugar crises, none of it as difficult as the struggle to stay in the game once you have suffered a setback like dropping a full quart of ranchero sauce, which has cracked open and exploded in your station all over your clogs and the oven doors. I like to swear the dirtiest, most vulgar swear words I can think of to get me through it. It can be very Tourette syndrome back there when I am working that egg station and the expediter has failed to tell me about a sauce on the side or a well-done poached. I always, to be sure, take the moment to apologize to everyone around me, to promise them that I am not serious, that nothing is personal. But then I rip it out, jaw tight, and spewing combinations of the word fuck that even David Mamet has not thought to put together. I have fired people who can't suffer their setbacks and petty failures. If they go down early and spend the rest of their 5-hour shift that way, it threatens to sink the whole boat, and that can't happen just because you burned your first omelet and had to refire it. You've got to get your G.I. Jane on. From too many years of going all day without eating, that freakish thing about restaurant work, water, water everywhere, and not a drop to drink, I have blood sugar issues, and they can feel serious. There are a couple of points in that shift, every single time I work it, that I legitimately fear that the entire brunch service will come to a screeching halt if I don't get some orange juice, iced Ovaltine, and a full quart of ice-cold Coca-Cola down my throat in seconds, and in that particular order. In a generous light, I am that boxer in his corner, his trainer squirting Gatorade indiscriminately at his face while the boxer keeps his mouth open like a gasping fish, hoping for the jet stream to get to his throat. But I can, in a less generous light, feel like a dirty glue huffer, shoving my head discreetly and desperately into my cool reach-in, sucking, and I mean sucking, down a quart of chocolatey, malty, milky Ovaltine over a quart of ice, like an addict puts that paper bag of paint fumes over his nose and mouth and pulls that shit into his body with a terrifying force, made more terrifying by the utter calm and clarity and complacency that overtakes you once your hit kicks in and reaches the right places. The Coca-Cola, so tannic and sweet and achingly cold that it makes my eyes tear up. And then brunch is back on track. During the 8th round, close to 3 o'clock, I get dizzy stupid. I don't even know what I'm cooking, by which I mean I know what each individual item in front of me is, but I don't know what I'm cooking in the larger picture. Is this the Eggs Benedict that picks up with the salmon omelette? Or is this the Benny that picks up with the oatmeal and lamb sausage? This may seem inane to anyone on the outside, but in my industry, which Benny is which matters. You don't just cook food indiscriminately, without phrases, without groupings, and carelessly shove it all to the past to let the expediter sort out. You have to time your food, according to a system, so that you don't produce a Benny that sits in the window waiting for 5 minutes for a lamb sausage from the guy working the grill station. 5 minutes in the life of a cooked egg, unlike a nicely resting piece of meat, is the difference between excellent and bullshit. At 3 o'clock, with the last pummeling of tickets on the board, I need to be told over and over by the expediter, and probably much to his irritation, which Benny is this particular Benny. I know all of the strategies, and I use them, repeating back the ticket after it's called, echoing the expediter, and constantly talking in minutes and seconds with my fellow line cooks. I'm 2 out on Benny Carbonara. 30 seconds on Huevos Pancake. Selling Benny Oyster. We break it down to each other from minutes to seconds to sold. But invariably, all I can see by the last round through my red, swollen eyes is the pan and the egg in front of me. I'm just punching and hoping I land one on the guy's jaw. To have a waiter pop back into the kitchen during this beatdown and tell you that Arlindo is outside, drilling holes through the sidewalk down into our wine cellar to drain his flower boxes, in a way so the water doesn't pool up in front of his front stoop, but instead now drains down. Where? Into the earth, does he imagine? Into the great, sweet, clean aquifer just below his front stoop? Here, in New York City? No, When his landscaping fever passes and he realizes, at the same time that I realize, that his flower boxes now drain into his own basement, which happens to be where all our wines with their once pristine labels are stored, I go slack in the neck from exhaustion. You want to own your own little place? You want to have a tight relationship with your farmer? Surround yourself with poet-philosopher wine merchants? Make your own ricotta and cure your own lardo? You want to be chef-owner? It's not the 18-hour days and the hot kitchen that'll get you. It's all that, plus a half-naked, 6'2", 240-pound man in front of your restaurant, drilling holes into the basement, and then watering his ivy.